today is significant in our calendar for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it is the day on which British summertime officially begins, as you can tell from the weather. And that's demonstrated by the fact that the clocks have already gone forward an hour. That is why we're all feeling a little bit tired this morning. We've lost an hour's sleep. The good news is that our mobile phones now change the time automatically, and so that prevents us from turning up to church an hour late, as used to take place on a regular basis. But then secondly, and more importantly, today is what is known as Palm Sunday, the day on which we remember Jesus' arrival in the city of Jerusalem. There was a vast crowd that welcomed him on that occasion. Some of them, as John tells us in his gospel, greeting Jesus with palm branches. And being Palm Sunday, this is the start of what has traditionally been called Holy Week, beginning today and concluding a week today with Easter Sunday. And as you read the four historically reliable gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, you discover that there was a lot that took place on this week 2,000 years ago. For example, in Mark 11, we read of Jesus' entry into Jerusalem and followed the next day by his clearing of the temple in Jerusalem. By the time you get to Thursday of that week, in chapter 14 of Mark, Jesus is celebrating the Passover with his disciples. And in verse 26 of chapter 14, we read that that meal was brought to a close by the singing of a hymn, and then they went out to the Mount of Olives. And from then on, one event quickly led to another. Events unfolded at a terrific pace, the result being that by the close of Thursday, Jesus has been arrested and he's brought before the highest Jewish court in the land, a court known as the Sanhedrin. And that is where we find him in chapter 14, verse 53. And the first thing that we see in this court case, which we're going to look at this morning, the first thing we see is in verses 53 to 61, and there we see the innocence of Jesus. The innocence of Jesus. Being a thoroughly religious society, first century Israel had religious figures occupying most of the important and prominent roles within society, including its legal system. And that is why we read of the arrested Jesus being taken in verse 53 to the high priest. And we read of all the chief priests, the elders and teachers of the law coming together. And being the highest court in the land, and being a court that was made up of devoutly religious men, you might have thought that if this court was going to be characterized by anything, then it would be characterized by justice and fairness. And yet what we read in verse 55 is that the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Isn't it strange? Rather than opening this case with an open mind and being willing to be led by the evidence, they are opening this case with a verdict already reached, and they are desperately looking for whatever evidence they can find that will substantiate their verdict, that verdict being guilty and the penalty being death. And if we had read the whole of Mark's gospel this morning, then that wouldn't really surprise us, because Jesus' death has been their intention and their ambition for a long time. It's a way back in the opening verses of chapter 2 that Mark records that occasion when the religious hierarchy, they accused Jesus of blasphemy because he claimed to forgive the sins of the paralyzed man. And since then, their opposition to Jesus has been both persistent and consistent and steadily increasing. You only have to go to the start of the next chapter, chapter 3, verse 6, and you read, "The Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus." That's way back in chapter 3. This plot against Jesus has been a long time in the making. Even earlier this week, as he taught in the temple courts, we are told in chapter 12, verse 12, they, that is the religious authorities, they looked for a way to arrest Jesus, but they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. But now that he has been arrested, their moment of opportunity has finally come, and all that they need to see, to see their long-term plans and agenda fulfilled, all they need to find is some scrap of evidence against him. But did you notice how verse 55 comes to a close? They were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they could not find any. They even went to the trouble of trying to fabricate evidence, but that didn't work because verse 56, many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Mark goes on to record one of the specific accusations that were made against Jesus during this court case. Verse 58, we heard him say, "I will destroy this man-made temple and in 3 days build another not made by man." They're referring to a statement Jesus once made, a statement that's recorded for us in John chapter 2, verse 19, where Jesus said, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days." They never understood the statement back then, because as John goes on to say, the temple he had spoken of was his body. They never understood the statement back then, and they obviously still haven't understood it. And what is more, they weren't even able to quote it accurately. Contrary to what they are saying, and contrary to what they thought, Jesus had never threatened to destroy the temple in Jerusalem. And so it was a misquotation. And it was a misunderstood quotation. And to make matters even worse, Mark tells us in 59 that they weren't even able to agree on their false and inaccurate reporting of what Jesus had originally said. Now, due to advances in forensic science and digital technology, as you know, legal evidence today can take various forms. There is usually some CCTV footage, as we saw last week with the attack on those ambulances in Golders Green. There are often fingerprints left at the scene, and there is, of course, DNA analysis. And as to what those things are evidence about what someone has done. But as to what people might have said, well, you better know that there are the emails that, if required, the Crown Prosecution can trawl through, as Peter Mandelson and Prince Andrew have discovered. And then there are the, you might say, well, I don't do email. No, but then there are the WhatsApp messages that they can go through, unless, of course, your name is Morgan McSweeney and your phone has been stolen. But then, in addition to all the digital and scientific evidence, there are the vitally important eyewitness accounts. Yes, even in an age of advanced technology, such testimonies are still considered to be vitally important evidence. And that is why witnesses are still summoned to appear in court cases today. But if you wind back 2,000 years, you think about it. There's no CCTV. There's no DNA. Well, there is DNA, but they couldn't read it. There's no fingerprint technology. There's no emails or WhatsApp messages. Only people's testimony as to what happened or what was said. Do you see how important people's testimony was back then? It was often all that there was in terms of evidence. And that is why there was a requirement in the Old Testament law on there being at least two people's testimony in a court case, and their testimonies had to be in complete agreement. But here in the trial of Jesus, we are explicitly told twice that there was no agreement between the witnesses on this occasion. Verse 56, many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Verse 59, regarding the specific accusation about the temple, yet even then their testimonies did not agree. And that is why when the high priest says to Jesus in verse 60, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" Jesus, we are told in verse 61, remained silent and gave no answer. It's not that Jesus was being awkward. Instead, his silence was due to the fact that there was no substantial accusation to answer. He did not need to respond, as no genuine charge has been brought against him. His silence is an expression of his innocence, and his innocence has been demonstrated by the inconsistent and inaccurate accusations that have been made against him. Rather than condemning Jesus, this court case has only served to reveal and to reinforce the innocence of Jesus. The innocence of Jesus. Moving on, secondly, verses 61 to 64, and there we see the identity of Jesus. Now, although Jesus remained silent when challenged by the high priest, it may be, if this doesn't sound a contradiction in terms, it may be that his silence said a lot, especially in the presence of men who ought to have been familiar with the Old Testament scriptures. And the reason I say that is because the Old Testament looked forward to the coming of one whom we are told in Isaiah 53 verse 7, which we'll be considering again tonight. We are told of one who would be oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He would be led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. That is an Old Testament prophecy concerning the future suffering messianic servant of God who was to come into this world. Whether the members of that courtroom, whether they made the connection between Isaiah 53 and the Jesus who was now standing before them is impossible to say. But what is interesting is that the very next question asked by the high priest was this, verse 61. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now, if you've been with us on Sunday mornings throughout the month of March, then you'll know that one of the big issues in Mark's gospel is the identity of Jesus. Who is this historical figure known as Jesus? Who is he? That was the question, you may remember, that the disciples asked themselves at the close of chapter 4. Who is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him. And that was the question that the disciples not only asked themselves, but that is the question that the disciples were asked by Jesus in chapter 8. Who do people say I am? And what about you? Who do you say I am? And as we approach the close of Mark's Gospel, and as we approach the closing hours of Jesus' life, we discover that the identity of Jesus is still a major issue. Because that is the question that Jesus is now being asked. The disciples asked it amongst themselves about Jesus. Jesus asked his disciples the question, but now it is Jesus who has been asked, "Who are you? Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now, if you're using a church Bible, you'll see from the footnote that the word Christ is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word Messiah. And that was a very familiar concept, would have been to these Jewish people. Because within Jewish society, there was a long history of eagerly awaiting and eagerly anticipating the arrival of the great messianic king that Old Testament scriptures like Isaiah had repeatedly promised. And the question put to Jesus on this occasion is, are you that one? Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of the Blessed One? In other words, are you the Son of God? Are you? As I pointed out last week at the baptism service, Mark chapter 1 records an occasion when God speaks from heaven and says concerning the identity of Jesus, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." In chapter 8, we heard the disciples, or Peter at least, say concerning the identity of Jesus, "You are the Christ." And now here in chapter 14, we hear Jesus himself speak concerning his identity. In response to the question, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus says, verse 62, "I am. I am." And just in case they're left in any doubt as to what Jesus is claiming for himself, he goes on to say this, "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." For people who knew, or at least ought to have known, their Old Testament scriptures, those words would have been familiar and full of significance. And I say that because Daniel chapter 7 spoke of one like a son of man, approaching God, being led into the presence of God, and being given by God authority and glory and sovereign power, the result being that peoples of every nation came and worshipped him. At the same time, Psalm 110 spoke of this future messianic descendant of David sitting at the right hand of God. And what we have here in the Sanhedrin is Jesus claiming to be the fulfillment of both. That is the divine person of Daniel 7 who is worshipped, and the ruling and reigning Lord of Psalm 110. That is what Jesus is claiming for himself. And if all that wasn't enough, Jesus reminds them that as the sovereign Lord, he's going to return one day on the clouds to be the judge of all men. The high priest had wanted to catch Jesus out on a claim to be the Christ. That was what he wanted to do, but he's got a lot more than he bargained for, because Jesus has responded. Not only by saying that he is the Christ, Jesus has responded by making a much clearer and a much fuller claim. Whatever their expectations of the coming Christ may have been, Jesus has left them in no doubt whatsoever as to who he really is. The Christ, the Son of Man, the Son of God. It was a claim which was unmistakably a claim to deity. And this high priest knew that. And that is why we read in verse 63, the high priest tore his clothes. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He's asking the rest of the court. What do you think? If he had asked you, what do you think? What would you have said? We read these words, they all condemned him as worthy of death. From as far back as chapter 2 and the healing of that paralyzed man, they have wanted to condemn this Jesus on a charge of blasphemy. And as far as they are concerned, they now have all the evidence that they needed. Now, back in chapter 2, I said that Jesus claimed to forgive the paralyzed man his sins, left us with the stark choice of either accusing him of blasphemy, as they did back then, or worshipping him as the divine person that he claimed to be back then. And once again, as we approach the end of Jesus' life, that is still the stark choice that we are faced with. Having said what he said on this occasion, Jesus has raised the stakes so high, not only for those members of the Sanhedrin, but he has equally raised the stakes so high for you and me this morning. Having unmistakably claimed to be the Christ, having unmistakably claimed to be the Son of God, having unmistakably claimed to be divine, Jesus has left those men back then and us many years later with the simple choice of either condemning him for blasphemy as they did, or worshipping him as Lord. That is your choice this morning. And in response, you might say, but David, hang on a minute. Come on. Can't I just believe in a Jesus who was just a nice guy? A Jesus who was a good moral example, an influential teacher who has left us with some commendable ethics. Can't I just believe in that kind of Jesus? Well, let me just say that Jesus was and did all of those things. He was a good guy. He was a great teacher. He did leave us with great ethics. But what you have to think about this morning, and especially so as we approach another Easter, what you have to remember is that the Jewish court of 2,000 years ago, they didn't condemn this man to death for claiming to be a nice guy. Do you honestly think they would have condemned a man to death for simply claiming to be a nice guy? Jesus wasn't condemned to death on this occasion for claiming to be a good man. Instead, they condemned him to death for claiming to be the Christ, the Son of God. And he either was or he wasn't. If he wasn't, if his claim was a downright lie, then is this the sort of person that you would look up to as being a good man? Is this the sort of person that you would describe as a man of commendable ethics? If his claims were a pack of lies? I doubt it. But if he was telling the truth, and if his claim to be the Son of God was true, then rather than seeing this Jesus merely as being a good example that we look up to every now and then, or as an ancient teacher that we quote from time to time, if his claim to be the Son of God is true, then here is one who deserves to be the supreme object of our love, our worship, and our allegiance in every area of life. The challenge at the close of Mark's gospel and at the close of Jesus' life is the very same as it was at the beginning. And that is the challenge concerning the true identity of Jesus. You have heard his claims this morning. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? In response, he said, I am. The high priest turned to the rest of the court and said, what do you think? And my question to you this morning is the exact same. What do you think? Moving on, we've seen the innocence of Jesus. We've seen the identity of Jesus. Finally, verse 65, and there we see the sufferings of Jesus. Following the unanimous sentence of death in verse 64, we read these words in verse 65, then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. Having heard Jesus claim to be the divine messianic fulfillment of Old Testament scriptures, they've blindfolded him and they are now asking him to prophesy each time someone hit him on the face with their fist. Prophesy and tell us who it was that hit you. In response to his claims to deity, their response is one of downright mockery and cruelty. And as you read on into chapter 15 of Mark's Gospel, you discover that during the remainder of that day, their cruelty and his sufferings only get worse, culminating in his death upon a cross outside the city. And so we are left with the question. And this is the question you need to think about as we enter another Easter. We are left with the question as to why the innocent one of verses 53 to 60 and the divine one of verses 61 to 64, why should this one suffer as he did? If he was simply an innocent man, then we might get away with saying, well, that this was nothing other than a terrible miscarriage of justice. And make no mistake about it, it was that. But the fact that he was not only an innocent man, but the God man, leaves us with the question as to why he should have suffered as he did. Not only suffer the cruelty of the courtroom, but then go and suffer the cruelty of the cross. Why should he have suffered as he did? The interesting thing is that as you read through Mark's gospel, you discover that Jesus was fully aware that this is what would happen to him. On more than one occasion, he told his disciples well in advance of these events that this is what would happen. For example, speaking to his disciples in chapter 10, he says, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed by the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. And yet, knowing all of that, knowing what lay ahead of him, he still makes his way to Jerusalem. And he did so because, as he himself says in Mark 10, verse 45, his reason for coming into this world was not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Did you hear that? He came to this earth and made his way to Jerusalem and ultimately to the cross for the express purpose of laying down his life as a ransom for people like you and me. Now, we're familiar, 2,000 years on, and we are still familiar with the idea of a ransom, in that occasionally you hear of someone being kidnapped and their captors demand a ransom. They demand a sum of money for their release. Now, thankfully, we only hear of that occasionally, but for first century people, it was a much more familiar concept. And it was a much more familiar concept because of slavery. Within every big town or city, there would have been a slave market where wealthy people could come and buy a slave for a certain price. But if a wealthy man came along and paid the required price, not with a view to acquiring the slave, but with a view to setting that slave free, then that price was known as a ransom, because it led to his freedom. And the reason Jesus came to give his life as a ransom is because, as Jesus made clear on another occasion, you and I are slaves. Did you realize that? We're slaves. And you might think, slaves to who? Nobody told me to get up this morning. Nobody told me to come here today. Nobody's controlling my life, and so in what sense can I possibly be a slave? It was Jesus himself who said, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. And you try and go this week, especially because it's called Holy Week, you try and go this week without committing a sin, without doing a sinful action, without saying a wrong sinful word, without having a wrong sinful thought. You try and go this week without committing a sin, and you'll discover that Jesus was right. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. And the purpose for which Jesus came and died was so that through his payment of the required ransom, sinners like us might be set free from the power and the penalty and the punishment of our sin. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That is Jesus' own explanation as to why he would suffer as he did. And so as we enter this Easter week, there are these three things from the proceedings in this courtroom in Mark 14. There are these three things that we need to seriously think about. The first is the innocence of Jesus. They couldn't find any fault in him, but still condemned him to death nevertheless. The second is the identity of Jesus. Not just what other people said about him, but what Jesus himself said about himself. And if he's innocent, and if he claims, and if his claims concerning himself were true, then the next question you need to think about is, why did he suffer as he did? As you look back 2,000 years to those events in the history of our world, what is your response going to be? Are you going to dismiss it simply as being irrelevant? Or are you going to trust him as the ransom that you desperately need?